is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiji Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
First, it was the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, then Sudan, and now Morocco agreed to establish full diplomatic relations with Israel.
That's Linda Grantstein reporting from Jerusalem. Details coming up. Also, Tigrayan forces have accused the Ethiopian government of partnering with the United Arab Emirates to conduct drone strikes. And authorities in Nigeria fear COVID-19 could spike again. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Israel and Morocco have agreed to normalize ties, U.S. President Donald Trump announced Thursday, making Morocco the fourth Arab country to establish diplomatic relations with Israel in the past 4 months. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to hold a phone conversation with Morocco's King Mohammed VI on Friday, with President Trump on the call. As part of the deal, the U.S. agreed to recognize Morocco's control of the Western Sahara. Linda Grantstein reports from Jerusalem.
First, it was the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, then Sudan, and now Morocco agreed to establish full diplomatic relations with Israel. A jubilant Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke after lighting Hanukkah candles at the Western Wall with U.S. Ambassador David Friedman.
The people of Morocco and the Jewish people have had a warm relationship in the modern period. Everybody knows the tremendous friendship shown by the kings of Morocco and the people of Morocco to the Jewish community there. I think that this is the foundation on which we can now build this peace. We'll resume liaison offices quickly between Israel and Morocco and work as rapidly as possible to establish full diplomatic relations.
As part of the deal, President Donald Trump said the U.S. would recognize Morocco's claim over the disputed Western Sahara region. The Sahara was a former Spanish colony and has been in dispute between the Moroccan government and the separatist Polisario movement, which is backed by Algeria. The Polisario group condemned the announcement and said it changes nothing in legal terms. Israeli analysts said they do not believe that U.S. President-elect Joe Biden will change the policy once he takes office. Bruce Matty Weitzman, an Israeli expert on Northern Africa, said the control of the Western Sahara has been Morocco's most important foreign policy issue since the 1970s.
So it's been a long haul for the Moroccans. For a long time, they've had the advantage on the ground, controlling 80% of the territory without any significant military threat to that control, but without the de jure international recognition of its claim.
Hundreds of thousands of Israelis have Moroccan heritage, and thousands travel to Morocco each year. Now they will be able to visit on direct flights. Linda Grantstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
A former United Nations official says if the U.S.'s recognition of Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara is sustained, in the future it would complicate the Security Council's efforts to resolve the Western Sahara problem. Ambassador James Jonah, former U.N. Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, says the U.N. has an established policy that the final status of the Western Sahara will be determined by a referendum. Ambassador Jonah says it is possible that another U.S. administration could reverse the decision, but if it is sustained and the U.S. uses its veto power in the Security Council, it could complicate efforts to resolve the Western Sahara issue. Ambassador Jonah referred to news reports which he says identified the Trump administration's recognition of Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara as a quid pro quo so that Morocco, an Arab country, would recognize Israel. Ambassador Jonah spoke with VOA Daybreak Africa host James Buddy.
The main difficulties I see is that if this policy is sustained in the future, it will complicate the Security Council's efforts to tackle the Western Sahara problem.
Why do you say that?
Because the United Nations has established a policy whereby it says the final status of Western Sahara will be determined by a referendum. The General Assembly has taken a firm position and even granted Polisario, the group fighting for Western Sahara, a status in the General Assembly. Even in the Security Council, when the Council meets to discuss Western Sahara, the Polisario representative is invited to speak. And this will complicate the problem amongst Security Council members. It may not prevent Polisario to speak, because it may be just a procedural issue. But if the U.S. maintains its position, it could use its veto right in the Security Council.
Do you think, Ambassador Jonas, this decision can be reversed by another U.S. administration?
That's why I said if it is sustained in the future. I don't want to predict what any other administration would do. Of course, they can change the policy. We have had many instances when policies have changed in an administration. It depends on how they see the problem. Yes, of course, it's possible.
So why do you think, Ambassador Jonas, that the Trump administration has put forward this policy?
It's very, very difficult to fathom what is happening in the last days of the administration. All I can say is, although President Trump did not say it in his announcements about recognizing the sovereignty of Morocco on Western Sahara, other news reports have linked the recognition to issues about Morocco trying to deal its relationship with Israel. But he didn't say it, but they said this is part of a quid pro quo.
You mentioned referendum in the Western Sahara. If there is a referendum, who will organize this referendum and who is going to participate in it?
That is the rub of a problem. The Secretary General of the United Nations, going way back to that time of Secretary General Kurt Waldheim, was authorized by the Council to appoint a special representative, which he did, and that representative was to organize a referendum. The problem then is who should participate? There has been no agreement between Morocco and Polisario, so there have not been any referendum, and that's why the whole issue has not been finally resolved.
That was Ambassador James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs, speaking to VOA's James Buddy. And now we turn to Ethiopia, where Tigrayan forces have accused the Ethiopian government of partnering with the United Arab Emirates to conduct drone strikes. The Ethiopian government denies the claims, and military experts say there is no evidence to support the claim, though worries persist about the proliferation of armed drones in Africa. VOA Salem Solomon spoke to experts to provide clarity and has the story.
Tigrayan forces have accused the Ethiopian government of partnering with the United Arab Emirates to use weaponized drones stationed in Eritrea. The Ethiopian government denies the claim, and security analysts say there is no evidence of the use of UAE drones in the region, but concerns are growing in the international community about the participation of outside actors in the conflict, as well as the use of drones in African conflicts. Wim Swinenberg is a humanitarian disarmament project leader for PACS, an organization studying conflict worldwide and conducting research on the use of military technologies.
It's true that there are Emirati drones based in Eritrea. However, the next question is, would they have been used in Ethiopia? And in that regard, we couldn't find any indication that the Emiratis would fly drones in Ethiopia.
Swinenberg has been studying satellite imagery collected by the U.S. company Planet Lab. He determined that drones operated by the UAE are stationed at the Aircham port city of Aseb. The 20-meter wingspan Chinese-made drones known as Wing Long 2 are capable of dropping bombs or shooting missiles. The Ethiopian government said it has conducted targeted strikes against strategic targets in Tigray region, but did not say whether the strikes were made by fighter jets or some other aerial platform. Major General Yilma Merdesa, the chief of the Ethiopian Air Force, told VOA Amharic that the TPLF is spreading falsehoods about other countries' involvement and that the central government didn't ask for any outside assistance.
We are attacking the enemy in three directions. First is an aviation attack. The second is a surface-to-air missile. And the third one, built over the past 2 years and one of the greatest capacities we have, is UAV, or unmanned aerial vehicle. We have trained and armed ourselves, and we are doing the work from the center, and other assertions are deception. We are destroying the enemy with a force we built ourselves.
Swinenberg said Ethiopia has the fourth largest air force on the continent, flying MiG-23 and Sukhoi-27 jet fighters. He said the cell phone video uploaded to Facebook appears to show fighter jets flying over the city of Meghale in northern Ethiopia.
We could not find any indication that those drones have been used by the Ethiopian Air Force, but only found indications that piloted aircraft, jet fighters, have been carried out targeted strikes. So in that sense, it's good to look at the statements made and fact check those with what we know from the ground and from open source information and satellite imagery.
There is precedent for the UAE piloting weaponized drones on the African continent. According to the UN, the UAE has conducted drone strikes, as has Turkey.
States have an interest in drones because it removes the risk from the pilot. And they're relatively cheap, and they can stay over a large area for a long time, making them very, sort of a seductive way to use lethal force in operations where you otherwise wouldn't expose your own troops to risk because they could have been killed.
Fact-checking efforts are enabled with the help of satellite imagery and other technologies as observers continue to monitor such activities. Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Somalia's presidential election was thrown into doubt this week after opposition candidates accused incumbent Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo of stacking the election committee that will run an important preliminary vote. The opposition have defiantly formed their own parallel committee, delaying the election and prompting international concern. Mohamed Kayi reports from Mogadishu.
There are more than 10 candidates in Somalia's indirect presidential elections, in which four big clans and other minority tribes choose members of parliament that will decide on the country's next head of state. The opposition accused the president, Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo, of bypassing the electoral law by stacking the poll committee with his allies. The committee coordinates the parliamentary elections before the presidential poll. Abdurrahman Abdishakur, one of the key opposition figures, told VOA News that the president put members of National Intelligence Agency, known as NISA, on the committee.
Our concern is about how the committee was made of. And we have some of the members, or majority of the members, are from the NISA, National Security Agency. And some of them are from the civil servants. And some of them are known supporters of the current president, Farmajo.
The international community, including the United States, has raised concerns about the political standoff in a country that's already facing threats from the armed group al-Shabaab. Ambassador Donald Yamamoto warned the opposition groups against subverting the election process.
The opposition must there's no delay. There is no change to the September 17th consensus. The United States and all the donor communities and partners are concerned about the electoral impasse.
The United States' recent announcement that it will withdraw its 700 troops who help the Somali security agencies battle al-Shabaab has further threatened Somalia's already fragile stability. Abdul Rashid Hashi, an analyst at Heritage Institute for Policy Studies, says the Somali government needs to show stronger leadership.
They are responsible for the security and well-being and political stability of the country, and they need to just sit with their colleagues. People who are, you know, they are arguing with are their predecessors. The former presidents are the ones that are actually leading the opposition groups.
Citizens like student Shafi Yusuf hope that there will be a peaceful poll where the outcome will be accepted by all sides in the race. He says, we need free and fair elections in which the results are accepted by all citizens, like previous transparent poll processes, with the winner supported by the whole political spectrum. Somali Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble pledged his administration will address all concerns raised about the elections, which are scheduled for February. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
The ruling African National Congress, or ANC's second most senior official, Ace Magashule, has been implicated in a long list of financial crimes, including graft. This weekend, Magashule will appear before his party's Integrity Commission. Darren Taylor reports.
3 months ago, after several ANC officials were charged with corruption related to the supply of COVID-19 personal protective equipment, President Cyril Ramaphosa said any ANC member charged with a serious crime will be suspended from the party. About a month ago, ANC Secretary General Ace Magashule was arrested and charged with fraud related to a multi-million dollar tender, but he remains behind his desk at party headquarters. Ramaphosa, however, maintains the ANC's still committed to ending corruption within its ranks.
There will be no dilution of the position that we have taken in this regard. The ANC needs to draw a very clear line in the sand between the organization and those who steal and those who commit other crimes against our people.
But opposition parties and civil society groups say the ANC's Integrity Commission is not that line in the sand. They've described it instead as a veil and a pantomime.
We have been demanding of the ANC that they stand up against malevolent politicians.
Magashule has denied allegations of wrongdoing and corruption, telling journalists he's a law-abiding citizen. Professor Adam Habib, Vice Chancellor of Wits University in Johannesburg, isn't convinced.
These guys have destroyed the country, they've destroyed our public institutions, they've been the cause of the loss of trust of the citizenry in the state.
The analyst points out that most ANC members who've in the past been implicated in crime remain firmly within the party's fold, despite its Integrity Commission recommending their expulsion. Some have even been found guilty of crimes and later promoted to more senior positions in government. Some ANC leaders have gone so far as to praise Magashule for his apparent willingness to appear before the commission, saying it shows he has a conscience. Habib says such a stance is an insult to the nation.
This is not a matter of conscience. It's not a matter of conscience. Because you're asking corrupt individuals to have a conscience. That's nonsensical. What we're saying is the organization must make it clear. If you're charged, you step aside. I don't care what your conscience says.
But the ANC says its critics should remember that Magashule is innocent until proven guilty. Again, Habib disagrees with its position.
Don't give me nonsense about innocent before guilty. All of that is for the court to decide.
He says it's obvious why the ANC and President Ramaphosa cannot enforce their own decision to suspend members charged with crimes.
Let's be honest. There is serious factionalism, And frankly, a big part of the ANC is utterly corrupt, including its leaders and part of its members. The whole thing is a patronage network in a significant...
Ramaphosa says the ANC can't be united with corruption. Habib says it's time for the president to live up to those words.
You cannot tell me we need to be united and we need to allow the corrupt to be united with us. So he's saying to the faction, leave the ANC, because frankly, there is no unity with the patronage networks that you guys belong to. That's the hard line. Now, it's a difficult decision to take, but it's the only decision he has if he is serious about fixing the challenges of this country.
Opposition parties say they'll applaud Ramaphosa only once his corrupt comrades are in jail. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
In Nigeria, authorities are worried that COVID-19 may spike again as millions ignore safety measures such as wearing face masks and social distancing. Timothy Abiezu reports from Abuja.
The coronavirus pandemic may be the least of concerns for thousands who buy or sell in this Abuja market daily. In March, the market was among many closed down in the city to stop COVID-19 from spreading. But since reopening, many traders here say they are trying to make up for their losses or basically survive. Some, like butcher Martin Olaya, continue to doubt the coronavirus ever existed.
We don't know what the coronavirus is. We haven't seen it. There's nothing that concerns Nigeria with that. God will not allow it.
Nigeria has recorded more than 67,000 cases of the coronavirus since its first case in February. The country reached its peak infections between July and August and then recorded a downward trend. But officials say COVID-19 infections started rising again in November, a time when many countries around the world are battling a second wave of the virus. Authorities worry many Nigerian citizens, especially younger people, are no longer vigilant. Experts say the EndSARS protests last month, which saw thousands of young Nigerians march against police brutality, may have contributed to the new rise. The use and sales of face masks and gloves have also dropped significantly. Nigerian authorities are trying to avoid imposing strict lockdowns by urging citizens to adhere to COVID-19 guidelines. Late last month, President Buhari warned citizens to avoid a second wave of the pandemic at all costs, noting that the country's already fragile economy may not withstand it. Anas Ibrahim, economic lecturer at a Nigerian university, agrees with the views of the president.
About 60 to 65% of the sectors that we have, that is the 46 sectors that we have in Nigeria now, they actually decline. They are not performing. They are not actually, you know, lucrative to actually make or to boost the economy in order to create more job opportunities and create a lot of revenue to the government.
Last week, Nigeria's Bureau of Statistics announced the country had plunged into a recession after its economy contracted by 3.6% due to COVID-19 disruptions. Authorities are hopeful that the economy will begin to recover early next year, but say citizens must take responsibility. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is the voice of America's Sonny Young. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the Sunny Side of Sports. On Fridays, you can also hear my expanded 30-minute edition of the show at 17:30 UTC, right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.